I was reading a book on the plane right over. It's the Joe Pepitone book. What do you remember about Joe when he was at the Yankees in 64?
I don't know. Is Joe still alive?
He's still alive.
Where is he, in jail?
I know he's not in jail. I know that he helps out with the Cubs fantasy camps with Randy Hundley. I know he still does that. And I know he also has been described as having the most natural-looking hairpiece of anybody on the planet. So as far as I know, he's still alive. But
well, you know, when he came up with the Yankees, he was supposed to be the next great one. But he never did live up to their expectations. He was a little flaky, but pretty good ball player.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't say too much good about Joe because he was a little wacky. He didn't know what he was going to do. I do know that Bruce Henry was the traveling secretary. And when we would go on a road trip, say for 2 weeks, say we'd go for 14 days, well, Bruce would come by and he'd give us an envelope with the cash in it, $10 a day, to eat on. Well, after the first road trip when Pepitone was there, 2 days later, Pepitone didn't have any meal money. Because he was running around with Mantle and Whitey, and he was living it up good. So the next road trip, it hand him out 2 or 3 days in advance.
Mm-hmm.
He'd have that 140 gone in 2 or 3 nights.
Okay, when you got to the Yankees in 64, what kind of shape was Mantle in?
Mantle was in real good shape, but his legs were still bothering him. I used to marvel at him because when he was hurting, they would tape him from here all the way up to here, whether it was his right or left leg. I think it was his left leg. And I've seen him in the clubhouse. He wouldn't have batting practice. And he wouldn't have infield practice, you know, when they had infield. He'd be in the clubhouse, and he'd be throwing the ball up against the wall, just catching it, throwing it up. And what marveled at me is I've seen him do this a couple of times. He'd go up to bat the first time, never had any batting practice. And I've seen him hit balls that were unbelievable, home runs. He hit one ball one day, left-handed. He hit the ball and threw his bat down in disgust, and the ball went into right center field bleachers. Whether the wind helped it or whether something happened to it, I don't know. But he had the power. But he was a pretty good hitter. And you never know what he'd have been if he had the good legs.
Jim, at the end of, well, not at the end, but in 42, when the Reds sent you to Columbus, and then you never made it back to the big leagues as a player anyway. Did you know at that point that your big league playing days were over, or did you always think that you'd make it back?
Well, I didn't think it was over at that time. But of course, you had all of the players come back from the war and everything, and I still thought I had a little chance in 40. 46, 47, but then, of course, I was getting up in age then.
Yeah. Was the adjustment from playing baseball when you were finally done playing at 50, in 1950 or whatever, to not playing every day, was that an easy adjustment for you?
Well, it wasn't easy because you still had the desire and you still wanted to play, but Father Time and Mother Nature took care of that. And of course, the last year I played was the Kansas City Blues in 1950. It got to be a struggle. Now, they say that your legs go first, but I figured it was my ankles. And I don't know what to contribute it to unless you're playing night ball out there in that moisture in the outfield, but that's where it affected me the most. When I'd get up in the morning, I'd have to sit on the side of the bed and run my ankles around for a while after you played a doubleheader. Well, I was 38 then.
When you coached for the A's in 62 and 63, I think the owner of the A's at that time was Charlie Finley.
That's right.
How did you get along with him?
The only time that I ever spoke to Charlie Finley, I spoke to him on the telephone, and I was scouting at the time. And Hank Peters, who was the head of the scouting outfit, and another scout by the name of Joe Bowman, and myself, were at the College World Series in Omaha. And Hank Peters, we got to talking about Finley, and he says, Finley's out in Arizona now. And he's romancing a family by the name of Snyder, a left-handed pitcher that went to, I think it was Arizona or Arizona State. And he says he's going to sign him in the morning, and he's offered him $100,000. And he was going to be our number one draft choice. So the next day, he gets word from Finley that Snyder had signed. He said he went in to see the Athletics play in California over the weekend or something, and he had been wine and dining Snyder's family all week, and he was going to sign with Charlie for $100,000. And Milwaukee come in while he was gone to see the play, see the A's play in California. Milwaukee comes in and gives the kid $105,000. So now Hank says, well, he says, we better go up and talk to Charlie. And he says, he'll probably be all upset because he lost his number one draft choice. Our second draft choice was a kid by the name of Fletcher, a little left-hand pitcher that pitched for Illinois University. No, I think it was Iowa University. Anyway, Fletcher was going to get out of school, and he was the number two draft choice on our list. So about 2 or 3 weeks before this, they sent me over to look at Fletcher pitch. Well, I like Fletcher, and I find out that he's gonna want a lot of money because I had played against his father, who was a pitcher with Indianapolis when I was at Louisville. And of course, you try to use all the angles you can get, and of course, when I talked to the old man, he didn't care too much about Finley and the organization. So we're back in Omaha, we go up to Peters' room to call Finley. And he said to me, he says, you're going to have to talk to Mr. Finley. I said, I've never talked to Mr. Finley in my life. He says, the first thing he says, it's not Mr. Finley, he says, you call him Charlie. So he got up and he got on the phone and he was raising hell because he had lost Snyder. Well, now we're going for Fletcher, the number two. So he finally puts me on the phone. I said, hello, Charlie, how are you, and all that. And he said, how do you like Fletcher? I said, well, I like him. I saw him pitch a couple of weeks ago. And he said, what do you think it's going to cost us? I said, it's going to cost you at least $60,000. He says, "Good God Almighty, don't you ever get any, don't you guys ever get anybody for nothing?" Well, he had spent millions of dollars during that spring to get Catfish Hunter and Blue Moon Odom, lived with them down in the shack down there where they lived. And it was kind of tough, you know, for Mr. Finley to be putting out all that money. But anyway, we didn't get either one of them. And Fletcher, the strange case about Fletcher, Detroit gave him about $60,000 or $65,000, and he pitched. Detroit sent him out to pitch, and he pitched 1 week and hurt his arm and hadn't pitched since. And then the draft comes in. Oh, this is before the draft, I think. It was in 1964, and there was a kid by the kid that pitched in the Ben Johnson League here in town by the name of Chuck Dobson. And of course, in 63, I was appointed to go romance the Dobson family. They lived right down here. He went to De La Salle High School. Mm-hmm. And of course, De La Salle and Rockhurst were rivals, bitter rivals. So I even had to end up going to this boy's graduation at De La Salle. But anyway, in the early spring, I went over to, you know, when you were scouting, you had to figure out who you had to deal with, whether it was the mother or the father who wore the pants, you know. So I went over to see Mrs. Dobson in the spring, and I didn't have to wait very long. She told me, she said, "I'm the one you got to talk to. I wear the pants in this family." Now, this was before the draft. So we had followed Dobson all through the Van Johnson League. Well, on this particular Sunday before he graduated, they were playing a game, and Jeff Dobson slid into third base and hurt his back. So now he graduates the following 5 or 6 days. So Pat Friday and Hank Peters and I go over to try to sign Dobson. And we had an appointment the morning after he graduated. And we go in, and we had decided if he wants 100, we're going to give him 100. So we went in, we kept talking and talking, and she said, "Well," we asked her what they wanted. She said, "I thought that's what you were here for, to tell us what you were going to give us." "Well, you can't do that, because she'll say, 'I'll let you know.' And then she'll turn around and she'll call Detroit, or she'll call somebody else and say, 'Well, I'm offered X number of dollars here. Can you beat it?'" So we decided not to do that. So finally we kept talking back and forth and back and forth, and hell, it must have been 2 hours. So finally Chuck said, he says, "I want $20,000 tax free." So now it gives Peter something going. And she turned to him and she said, "You shut up, I'm running this thing." In the meantime, Peters writes out the contract. We were going to give him his $20,000 tax free, which amounted to about $43,000. We were going to give him an incentive bonus for $7,500. if he stayed in the big leagues after so much time. We were going to give him $700 a month for 3 years, wherever he played. Peter's got the whole thing in his hand. Got two copies. At that time, you only had to have one parent's signature. So she hands the contract, one to Chuck, one to the mother. And then, you're going to stop